Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, to this lecture, which is part of the series organised by the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics. Over the years, we've had the pleasure of hosting many leaders from Greece, from politics, business, finance, academia, etc. And we're pleased to welcome our speaker this evening, Dr. Nikos Pappas. We reminded ourselves a few minutes ago that we hadn't met for the last 10 years, but it's great to welcome you back to the LSE as part of this series. Now, I guess to every Greek member of the audience here, our speaker Nikos needs almost no introduction. But for those of you who are not Greek, let me introduce our speaker this evening. Nikos, of course, at the moment is Minister of Digital Policy, Telecommunications and Media. Before that, he was Minister of States and therefore, I guess we could say, Chief Spokesman of the Government for the Syriza Government. He was Chief Spokesman during interesting times, particularly the 2015 clashes with the Eurozone leaders. Clearly, he is a political personality of some stature, of some magnitude, but is also a trained economist with a PhD from the University of Strathclyde. And I think we should acknowledge that any foreigner who's been able to go to Glasgow and write a PhD and to be able to talk comfortably with the locals deserves at least a PhD, if not an honorary professorship at the university. My Scottish friends will now attack me in the social media afterwards, but I should also say that to his credit, in 2015, the Strathclyde University Students' Union gave him the honour of being a lifetime member in recognition of his contribution to, quote, fighting injustices against working people. So clearly we have a speaker of great profile that we want to listen to this evening. As usual, we're inviting Nikos on this occasion to speak for 30, 40 minutes. There should therefore be plenty of time for questions and answers afterwards. I imagine there is a Twitter feed, so if you want to tweet about the event, we look forward to seeing those comments. Surely for someone talking about digital communications, telecommunications, we must have a Twitter feed about this event. But let's then proceed. And can you please join me in giving a very warm welcome to the London School of Economics for Dr. Nikos Pappas.
Well, thank you all for being here. Thank you for the warm welcome, Kevin. And first of all, I need to say that I'm ashamed for being the Minister of Digital Policy coming in to give my speech from a printed version. It should be a tablet that I would be using, and I will need some assistance in using the presentation.
Fine. I think I'm able to. I think you could. Here.
Okay. That is nice. Okay.
This is probably the only occasion I've given anyone advice using technology.
Yeah, but it's quite an occasion, eh? Giving advice to Minister of Digital Policy.
Of course.
Gives you extra credit.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. Thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really very, very pleased to being in the London School of Economics and Political Science for the occasion of this very nice and warm event. And I think that we are touching upon an issue that will be at the top of the political agenda in the months and the years to come. You have probably heard of this story quite a few times. It was Frederick Remington, the famous artist who brought to life American images of the West, and he was hired by newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst to illustrate the revolution erupting in Cuba. Remington wrote back to his boss in January 1897. Everything is quiet. There is no trouble. There will be no war. I wish to return. His boss called him back immediately. Please remain, not remain, remain. You furnish the picture and I'll furnish the war. When the USS Maine exploded in the harbor in Cuba on the 25th of January 1898, Hearst's newspaper soon ran a story with the following title. The warship Maine was split in two by an enemy's secret infernal machine. So the first thing that slipped beneath the waves of this battle was the truth. This is why you've heard this story again and again, because it is one of the first stories illustrating how the press sometimes twists the truth in order to sell more. And that was only the 19th century. So publishing lies is not something fresh, is not something new. Democracies, citizens, and the press itself have coped with this phenomenon for a long time. So what is the difference? Why are we discussing once again? The name of fake news appeared and flourished during the summer of 2016, almost everywhere in the world simultaneously. And that was the beginning that this term was used to show the diffusion in a great wave of false information, mainly on social media and especially on Facebook. In less than 2 years, fake news is an expression used about almost everything, in press, politics, in everyday life from people in the left as from the people in the right. There are those who claim that we should abandon the term. Should we? Should we just consider, as I said, that it is an old phenomenon? Printing and reproducing lies has been there forever, so there's nothing new to discuss, case closed. Is this the approach that we should choose? I would argue no. And why is that? Because the speed with which this false news, this fake news, travel around the world is phenomenal, and spreading this kind of news can affect everyday life of citizens. And this is a saying by Mark Twain: a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. I think it's quite important to keep that in mind. It was the late 19th century that the great Mark Twain said this very, very important words. And I think that it is an important point. The second point that I would like to make is that we should not tend to explain the information crisis by this continuous flow of fake news. It is the contrary. Fake news is a phenomenon due to the crisis of information. And I will try to argue about both my points. In 1988, the Americans, Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky, published a book with the title Manufacturing Consent, the Political Economy of the Mass Media. Their argument is that American media make a crazy mess about the public dialogue and how. They make a crazy mess because news information is shaped by a handful of news media companies that monopolize access to information. We have, as mediators, large-scale advertising campaigns that try to control and block out publications that they regard troublesome or publications that do not comply with what they would want the public to get to know. And of course, journalists protect their high-rank sources by not publishing anything that could contradict them. As a result, we have a fake national consent that ignores facts, diverse views, and different ideas. This was their approach. Keep in mind, few media, large-scale advertising campaigns, and synergy between politicians and journalists. And the result of this engineering was what they called the national consent. The national consent has dominated media for the past 30 years. It has created an environment where information is filtered through certain filters and only this. The vision of life, the vision of the world should remain the same. When media started losing credibility, however, in the mid-90s, we should have been more worried than we actually were. By we, I mean everybody, politicians, academics, citizens, journalists, because media is one of democracy's gatekeepers, and when it goes down, the foundations of democracy tremble. And we should have known that. Now, what is going on today? Today, practically, media out there are infinite. The advertising industry, contrary to the assumptions of Chomsky and Herman, doesn't opt for large-scale campaigns, but prefers smaller, focused ads. And politicians no longer need journalists to reach the public, since they can use social media. These monumental differences would be sufficient to overcome the Chomsky-Herman approach. And one thus would argue that we are now in a more democratic, postmodern world with pluralistic and diverse views. And to a point, this is true. But it is not completely true. It also means that hate speech, extremist ideas, and fake news could also travel around the world more easily. Many recent studies have demonstrated that the public mostly follows news that appeal to their interests, convictions, and mainly their feelings. Two are the predominant emotions in modern day, fear and anger, just as described in the post-truth era. In other words, we passed from consent, agreement, to disagreement, controversy, or even conflict. This model was reversed the minute we believed that information could come for free, that we can access at no cost. We thought that we no longer need journalists as mediators because we can go straight to the source. But by suspending journalists, we suspend evaluation, ranking, validation, cross-checking, and, of course, accountability. And all this happened at a time that information was more abundant than ever. A few years ago, people who believed in fake news or similar theories were not suffering from paranoia. They were suffering from what has been called crippled epistemology. That is a scientific term that describes lack of information and access to erroneous information. People believe that they know something which they actually don't. This is exactly what the readers of Hearst's publication that I mentioned in the beginning suffered from. They believed that the Spanish infernal machine sank the US battleship because they had no other means of knowing the truth. Today, the situation is not only different, it is exactly the opposite. People still suffer from crippled epistemology because they are being overdosed by information they cannot evaluate. And as we all know, sexy titles about sensational events are read more than in-depth analysis or serious reporting. And let me at this point, in order to illustrate with an example my argument, to remind you of a story that has run in British media in 2015. And I would argue also that when Syriza took the second place in Greek politics, we had a wave I would say, of systematic campaigns and misinformation about our agenda and about what we intended to do had we won government. Needless to say, and I mean, I don't need to put a lot of effort to remind you, numerous newspaper titles that we were about to take the country out of the Eurozone. Guess what? It didn't happen. We had an exit of another country, but that was not Greece. So, this is only... This is just an illustration of what a reader of a newspaper in Britain would perceive as to what is going to happen in Greece, although we have been saying the opposite. Of course, this wave kept going on even after our win in 2015, and I'm wondering, should we just blame new media for the fake news? No. New media, social media, are the tool, the platform on which fake news can travel very fast. Traditional media very often can be the source of fake news. What do we see here? That is a GDP diagram, and it has to do with Greece. So, recession. Yes? No? Recession or growth? Recession, growth? Growth, because there is a little trick. The horizontal axis is reversed. So it counts time backwards. Please pay close attention to that and tell me how would you call it. I would call it propaganda. Amusing propaganda, because this is not something we very often do, you know. We count time the other way around. So, I mean, if you adopt this kind of approach for the time of crisis, you might get the idea, the first impression, that Greece was flourishing while it was being destroyed. So, I'm showing this just to make the exact point that it is not the social media that we must demonize. Of course, we have to be careful. There are new kinds of dangers rising up, but traditional media very often leave aside any kind of following particular rules that journalism should abide to and do a different job that they are not supposed to be doing. Another example. What do we have here? We have a post saying that we have breaking news. A farmer has beat up a deputy of Syriza. He's fighting for his life. Well done, boy. Well done, boy. The deputy is fighting for his life. Well done, boy. The deputy has actually stood up and said that this has never happened. He only had a nice time with his friends in a restaurant. Some people approached him and they asked him not to vote for a particular bill that we were putting into government on those days. He said, I'm sorry, I cannot discuss about that now. I'm having a private moment with friends. That was all, case closed. But this kept going on for days after the deputy had come up in public and said that what has been reported never actually happened. And these are posts from later days about the same so-called incident. Of course, this kind of thing can become dangerous. What? Here we have another post that is a capture from a website that gives the news of preparation of the Turks in the Greek-Turkish border. And it seems that Turkey has been constructing an anti-tank ditch 50 meters wide. It seems that in December we will have 70% of the works being completed, blah, 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 blah. And, of course, that was completely false. And as a proof, they have used this, which is funny, and this is supposed to be the notes of a Turkish official, which was stolen by Greek official. And they're supposed to explain how these details would work. But imagine that this kind of misinformation could actually escalate and create situations that we would all want to avoid. So we have an issue of responsibility that has not been fulfilled. As I mentioned earlier, when Syriza was elected and started reforms in Greece without any help or encouragement from the media, one of the most main reforms that we have pursued has to do with television. You must be familiar, if you have been following Greek politics, with some elements of the media history of Greece. Until 1989, we only had the state television, and then we had a process of opening to private TV channels. As many other things in Greece in the previous year, because now things are getting into line, it was not done in an appropriate way. What practically happened, whoever had the guts took up an antenna, set it up in the Mount of Imitos, and started broadcasting without a proper licensing procedure. As a result, this kept going on for 30 years, the public television was abandoned, and private channels, without any licensing procedure, which has been clearly predicted in our constitution, kept broadcasting, and of course, media owners acquiring influence, money, and power. So the years passed, we had the analog frequencies being attributed like that, and while we passed, at the time that we passed to digital terrestrial television, what happened, and this has created extra problems, is the fact that the company that developed the network was the company that belonged to the media owners themselves. That is, content providers and network providers were exactly the same people. We're talking about a huge conflict of interest. You understand, of course, why I'm saying that. There is no chance for a competitor or for somebody who's interested to join this kind of market, to join it and be sure that proper rules of competition would be followed if the competitors hold the keys of his ability to access the public in a proper way. This is something that kept going on, and I think we are now in a position to say that very, very soon TV licensing is going to be concluded. We have a new regulator, and they have concluded with a tender, and they are checking the economic statements of those that want to have a license, a TV license, and I think we will very soon be in a situation that is complying with our constitution. We have been violating our constitution since 1989, and this is coming to an end. Now, because the issue also has got to do with fake news, and the internet is the major platform upon which fake news travel around the world. We were very concerned about that, and for this and other reasons, we took the initiative of setting up an online media registry. What is this? This is a unified registry that has been established for the first time in the country, whereas all online media have to register, be clear about who they are, how many people they employ, and where they reside. So what, one would ask? Well, the leverage we have is expenses made by the state for advertising. So if someone is not in the register, they cannot have access to public funds, which means whoever wants to have even a euro spent on his business by the state has to register and be clear. Are we secure in terms of fake news? No, we are not. So, of course, you're not getting any money if you're not coming into the register, but what happens if you come into the register and you keep telling lies? Well, there is not much the government can do there, and we're not going to be policing what people would publish. I would urge the community of the people that work in online media to kind of self to a self-policing approach. I would happily see a democratically elected committee of the people that work in media making sure that they safeguard the rules of journalism in online media as well. And we would happily pursue with the legislation that would recognize the legal authority to such a committee to kick out of the register any participant that does not comply with the code of conduct that they have abide to. More than 1,000 websites have been registered, 580 companies, entities, and I think this is something that has been embraced well and can actually be a tool that will help us improve the way we perceive, we receive news from the internet. Now, on another initiative, which was also published today, the common ministerial decision was published today and uploaded on the Avia. It is the barcode in newspapers. We have a lot of grey areas in the distribution of the traditional press. And here we also have a conflict of interest because owners of newspapers are also owners of the agencies of distribution of the press. So if Kevin Featherstone has got a newspaper, he has to trust that his competitor would distribute his newspaper in an appropriate manner. That creates, as you can understand, a lot of problems. And, of course, it leaves a lot of space for grey areas in terms of not allowing us know what is the exact amount of newspapers that has been sold every day, because we only have estimations from the competitors of Kevin Featherstone as such. They have an incentive of presenting that their newspapers sell a lot and other newspapers do not. So what do? We will develop a system, an automated system, that will give us the opportunity to record at real time how many newspapers have been sold, where, and this information is going to be public. So, what do we need to do? We must devote resources. We must put on huge effort. We, of course, are not the only ones in Europe that are thinking about this problem. At the end of January, Prime Minister Theresa May and French President Emmanuel Macron announced strategies to fight fake news. At the same time, the European Commission has formed a group of experts and has dialogued with member states to address the same problem. There is an ongoing public consultation as well as consultations with member states and stakeholders. Soon, measures will be taken, most probably in every European country, probably elsewhere in the world. And together with us, the governments, I think that social media platforms themselves have to devote more resources in order to protect citizens from fake news, as these platforms are the ones on top of which fake news travel. Recently, Facebook announced major changes in its algorithm that will tackle the problem, and Google has also made announcements about raising its checking staff. But they will have to do more, much more. Social media is the main support for the propagation of fake news. They should be heavily involved in the battle against it. We must, however, keep in mind, no matter how many algorithms are invented or how many journalists practice cross-checking on a full-time basis, the problem would persist. Children in developed countries are spending more time using new media technologies than any other activity. Many of them are merging the new with the traditional by using laptop, tablet, and mobile phone simultaneously watching TV. Sometimes they interrupt football matches with Ariana Grande songs or something like that. It has happened to me last week. It was an awful experience, I regret to say. But that kind of scared me. The fact that I realized how familiar my 10-year-old daughter is with this kind of technology, that she can interrupt the football game for her favorite video clip, and she started dancing in front of me. I, of course, was worried. The first thing that I thought was that instead of prohibiting children to use this kind of tools, because, I mean, we politicians have sometimes a tendency for this kind of prohibitions, we have to fight very much to make them aware of the dangers that exist in that field. And in that effort, we have to kind of unite forces. And politicians, academics, the community of media, and of course, new dangers come with the new opportunities, but I'm sure that like other times in human history, we can make sure that new technologies are used in a way to make our everyday life better. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, thank you, Nick. It is, as you say, a very interesting, challenging subject for any country, but also internationally as well. It's by its nature, it's something which creates difficult issues in every modern society. As you were speaking, one of the thoughts I had was... whether technology is a friend or an enemy of modern democratic politics. And I guess the case for saying that it's an enemy is that the technology itself seems to exacerbate a divisiveness in politics. Social media is quick. Social media can be very aggressive, very antagonistic, way over the top in terms of personal attacks. And also, I'd have to say that in terms of even tonight's lecture, there was a lot of traffic on social media. Why had Kevin invited Nikos Papas? And I thought, well, it's answer number one, we're a university. Answer number two, it's an important topic, etc., etc. But it's symptomatic that with social media, there is more voice, more speed, and there is more aggression with it. And so as you were speaking, I was thinking perhaps technology is actually more an enemy of proper political debates and democracy than a friend. But as Minister for Digital Technology, would you agree or disagree?
Strongly disagree. From the very beginning, I must say that, and I think that your question has been provocative enough to keep the discussion going. Well, technology is a tool. I mean, you can use a hammer to for good, like put a nail on the wall and have a nice painting, or hit someone in the head. There will always be people that will use technology for aggression. I mean, I spend a lot of time reading, and I see that there are lots of initiatives and tools being developed, tools for quality journalism, for example, and applications that kind of filter what has been written around about an issue and provide to you an overall approach that you would be able to come to had you been reading the traditional press, for example, like picking up articles that are more in depth, and so giving you the opportunity to have access to what you should have instead of, you know, crippled epistemology things that fly around. I mean, in all terms, I think new technologies can be make our societies more democratic, more open to dialogue, but of course they come with the dangers that you have mentioned. At the same time, it's exactly the same example, like new technologies can be either a source of social convergence or a source of social diversity.
I wonder if I may, I guess the job of a chief spokesman of a government years ago...
That is quite a speculation.
Was very different. A chief spokesman for a government in the 70s or 80s in any country had to deal with a slower pace and a rather more restricted audience or participation. We think in terms of your role as chief spokesman for the government as being something which is so immediate to react now. Donald Trump has his tweets. It's all immediate. It's now. It's a more aggressive style. But I guess the technology creates a certain political style, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
As I refer to here, I'm aware that Nikos Papas, people love him or hate him. And media seems to...
Yeah, but that's not because of social... Yeah, but that's not because of social media.
Okay.
I think that is because of traditional media and some political choices that we have taken in the recent past. But listen, you can be a politician that makes no choices, expresses no opinions, and just as you can present yourself, talk for a long time without saying anything, but that's not very useful in the end of the day. Of course, yes, things have changed, and this is the point I try to make by referring to the works of Noam Chomsky. Mm. I mean, I can recall a very famous editor in Greece. He used to tell me stories about like 40 years ago that it was then a very, you know, closed club, the people that would get information from the chief spokesman of the government. So it were only five people allowed in. No, nobody else would... I mean, this is all finished now.
Yeah.
That's all gone. Of course, we take that into account. You have to react spontaneously a lot of times, and this creates a lot of risks because we make this or that choice. But such is life. I mean, yeah.
Okay. One of the other themes of your lecture was talking about the change in Greece from 1989 to the present and the allocation of new TV licensing to have a proper regulatory system. I guess a proper regulatory system also has the challenge of having something which remains stable and something which is inclusive. Political parties can buy into that. It lasts for more than one government over time, etc. Let me make a wild, wild guess here that this is not necessarily going to be achieved in the Greek case if there's a change of government. Isn't that then a problem that you're right that regulation is crucial, but if the regulation doesn't remain stable, if it doesn't have a political consensus behind it, then it can become part of the problem. The licensing can become part of the problem itself. So what can you do to establish a licensing system for the TV channels that perhaps the main party of the opposition would buy into as well?
I think that, it's been so long ago that we started this discussion. I feel it's like a couple of centuries ago that we started the discussion of what we should do with the licensing. And the discussion started from a stage that we were saying that the number of licenses should be limited, like it is everywhere in the world, and the opposition was saying that it should be limitless. I mean, this is very long ago. I think we now have a consensus on two major issues that have been resolved by the development of things. One is that we have a limit in the number of licenses. We issued 7 licenses, 7 TV licenses, and we only had 6 applicants. So, I mean, this takes away the whole discussion whether we can have infinite TV channels. I mean, of course, if the idea is that if somebody is allowed to use the scarce national source of frequencies, he or she has to do it with particular rules. You cannot just jump on it and broadcast whatever you want, hatred speech or inappropriate content. Or plus, you have to abide to the rules. What are the rules? The rules that are written in our constitution are saying that you have to present political opinions in a balanced way and not reverse the time axis of the GDP diagram, for example. So I am quite optimistic, I must say, Kevin. I think that we have reached now a consensus which says, one, we have a limit in the number of licenses. Second, the people that have got a license have to pay a fee that they have not been paying in the previous years. We have a regulator. The regulator has issued unanimous decisions that we have welcomed, and I think we are at the final stages of this procedure. Now, what is the crucial point? Are we going to solve all the problems? Are we going suddenly move from a situation where you have biased media to media that are not biased? No, this is not going to be the case. But since 1989, some people felt that they have hijacked the frequencies, and they did it without our democracy being there to impose the democratically decided rules. This is the major shift. Now we have the state imposing particular rules and making sure that our constitution is, in fact, followed for the first time in 30 years.
Okay. Let's open the conversation then to the audience. I think there are colleagues with microphones. Could you please indicate if you'd like to ask a question, and could you simply say who you are and then come to the question, please? Could you take the gentleman in the centre?
No need to say who you are. We cannot hear you. I think that the microphone
is the microphone on? This is a lecture about technology.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
Yes. Okay, Dimitri Munoz from the Hellenic Engineers Society of Great Britain. Excellent presentation. I fully agree with the premise that circulation of newspapers should be checked and channels, TV channels, should be licensed. It's way overdue. All Western European, EU countries have got that system. The only comment I have to make is, in your presentation, you didn't mention at all the role of government. Now, as far as I'm concerned, government, not only in Greece, but overall, have always handled the media, releasing news as and when they thought they should. Bad stories coming out during Princess Diana's death or the war starting or things like that. So again, don't you think that there's a lot of blame on the way the governments of all countries release news and make people a lot more skeptical as to what is the truth and what is missing?
Can we take some more questions? The gentleman at the very back and then the lady here. The very back.
Thanasis Gavos, I'm a journalist here, and I work for Sky. Picking up on what Mr. Munoz said, because we see what President Trump does, dismissing everything, any opinion that he doesn't agree with as fake news, usually. I was somewhat puzzled by the fact that you included that Times headline about the referendum result, which was, I think, you know, a judgment by a British colleague on what had happened in Greece. Although, because I do work for Sky, the graphic that you presented, I haven't watched it, but I think it was, you know, a mistake. You could easily read that there was growth in Greece. But my question is, where do you draw the line exactly between, as you said, dismissing fake news or avoiding fake news with rejecting a fact that you don't agree with as fake news?
Okay, good. And could we take the lady at the front, please? Very front here.
Hi. Is this? Okay.
Yep.
I'm Eliza. I'm a student here. I'm doing a master's in media and communications. So I'm going to ask you a question under that capacity and under my other capacity, which is I'm a journalist for Athens Live, which is an independent media startup that you're aware of. So most of the studies that come out of media watchdogs and independent authorities that are not government authorities say that media pluralism and media freedom in Greece is right now at the worst state that it has ever been, ever, since the 80s. There was a study by the Center for Media Freedom that came out last week, and it said that especially with regards to transparency of ownership, we are at a very, very high risk for losing that. And when you talk about the TV licenses, I mean, when I heard the measure as a citizen, I was surprised that the way for a government to halt corruption is to hold an auction and sell those channels to the highest bidder. And that's why the first auction that was held, we got people like Marinakis owning a channel, who is a very, very shady person. So in relation to that, as someone who has worked for an independent media startup, and we're quite a small organization, we have received zero support from any government agency. So the same thing can be said about the Press Project and other really, really important initiatives that are really breaking through the traditional media. So, yeah, it's not exactly a question.
Okay. Three nice, simple questions.
Yes.
For you.
Well, of course, governments have their own share of responsibility. I mean, you should not expect governments not to be politically biased. They are politically biased by default. The point is what kind of a system we built and what kind of checks and balances we have. I mean, this is going to be always in question. And of course, it is the case that we always must create an environment, and of course in Greece this is the case, that we are always openly criticized for things that we have never done. Okay. Now, forgive me, my friend, I do not think that the false diagram has been a mistake. It has been done on purpose. That's what I believe, and I have the obligation to say it quite frank and openly to the audience and to the people that watch us, probably through the internet. It will take a lot of effort to convince me otherwise. And, of course, I mean, we have a lot of cases where fact-checking has not been the case. I mean, if I'm not wrong, a journalist has to double-check a source. Has that been the case in choices that particular media have been doing, especially in Greece? And, I mean, let's not complain about the country because, I have been familiarized with the U.S. media because I've traveled twice this year in the U.S., and the situation there is also very polarized, even in terms of media.
Can I just ask, are you suggesting that's a kind of aberration for Sky or by Sky?
Oh yes.
Or is it?
Oh yes.
You must have.
But it's not the only one. But I mean, this is not a surprise. I mean, I say that in public and without any problem. They can make their choices. They can criticize. They can. I mean, but when
Sky isn't necessarily your favorite channel.
Well, I will not be so eager to say no immediately, because it's sometimes very amusing to watch things that have never happened being presented in the news. I mean, it's quite an option to make choices like the one that I have shown above, or claiming things that happened, that things happened that have never happened, like a Syriza member was driving a boat that killed 11 people. And this, you allow this to go into mainstream media, and this accusation flow around until the public finds out that no such thing ever happened. And I think, especially in cases like that, a degree of responsibility should be appropriate. And we should not take this kind of choices. Now, on the licensing procedure. Look, the licensing procedure has to do with the use of a scarce resource. Of course, TV is changing radically now. And probably this is the last licensing procedure that takes place. It might be the case that in the next 15 years, this kind of thing becomes obsolete. If all citizens have got connectivities that allow them to watch non-linear television over the internet, watching television through the network of antennas that are around the country will be irrelevant. You ask me about why this or the other person acquired the license. Well, this has been a critique that we have been listening to quite often. Legislation in Greece is very, very clear. Only if a person is convicted can be excluded from public tenders. There is no other legal way to exclude somebody from a public tender. That's one. Second is that I must stress to the audience and to the people that watch us now that the preconditions that we have put in the legislation for acquiring a license for the first time in history are so strict in terms of quality. First, number of people that work in the channels, it has to be minimum 400. They have to be able to do a simultaneous broadcasting in HD and SD, standard definition and high definition. There are preconditions for the size of the studios they have. There are preconditions on the machinery and the equipment they have. Yes, because they are allowed to use a scarce resource of the nation, the frequencies. And in order to be able to do that, you have to follow particular conditions. We could go to a choice and give licenses for black and white TV. Would that be in the interests of the citizens? Lower quality and allow whoever wants to broadcast without any particular fee or any particular preconditions. No, we have the obligation of making the best use of this scarce resource and make sure we open to the possibilities that the new technologies give, and make sure that the people, and especially the poor people, because it is the poor people that do not have access, for example, to pay TV, to cable TV, to satellite TV. There are people in the outskirts of our cities that can only watch free-to-air channels. And it is those people's rights that we need to protect. So in that sense, I would say that it is the first time that we make sure that we have such preconditions that are very, very strict, quality requirements, that when met, then the only thing left to have is the bid. Okay. So, I mean, there is a very high threshold of quality,
and whoever goes above that can then bid for a license.
Okay, let's have another round of questions, and suddenly there's an explosion of questions. Could we have the gentleman and then the lady over here, please?
Yes, hi, thank you. Following up at your previous answer, it's not clear to me, what's the aim of the regulation here? Having good quality broadcast in terms of image, HD, all these things, or good quality news? Because if you want to have a good broadcast, then agreed, the aim of the regulation is clear to me. But it seemed to me you also aim to have good quality news, whatever that means. And I'm not sure how giving a threshold of, you know, very good quality, big studios, actually ensures that. It seems to me it ensures the fact that, you know, only people who actually have the money to do that will bid for these kind of things. It's not really, you know, tied to quality.
Okay. And then the lady in front.
Katerina Klinyadaki, PhD student here. Mine is also a follow-up question to what you just said. So you mentioned a couple of times, at least, that there is a scarce, in terms of frequencies, there are scarce frequencies, there are scarce of resources. And this is not very clear to me. What does this mean practically? And also why this is the case? And it seems to me this is a very important point. But if you could elaborate a bit. It's a very, very basic question, but please elaborate on this. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. And then could we take the gentleman at the very front?
Hello. My name is Megakles Rogakos. I'm an art historian and an exhibition curator. I have been watching Greek television when I go to Greece, and I have to say I'm not very pleased with the quality, considering what's happening abroad, what's happening in England. I find that the quality of the government television channels are not that great. I mean, unfortunately, for this very bad quality, in terms of, I find the journalists to be inexperienced or not selected axiocratically. As a matter of fact, meritocratically. I would rather see journalists from various parties appointed in our government, in our television channels, the national television channels. And the other thing is the charges, the huge charges that that Greek citizens, all Greek citizens are charged, regardless, you know, people are paying huge amounts of money on their electricity bills for the Greek television, when actually the quality, as I said, is not that high. So that pisses me off as a Greek citizen. Thank you.
Okay, a very precise question. Thank you. Shall we take those?
Yeah,
those three?
Take two more.
Well, we'll have another round.
Okay.
I promise.
Yes.
What's the aim of the regulation?
Yeah. Well, the watchdog of the news is supposed to be the regulator. So the regulator has to make sure that in terms of content, the government cannot do something about it. The regulator is there to say, no, this should not have been broadcasted, or by broadcasting this, you have insulted such and such, or you have used hatred speech, you're not allowed, or it is inappropriate content for midday. This is not our job. This is what the regulator has to do. On the other side, in terms of content, yes, we can take measures to make sure that quality content reaches out to Greek people. And as I mentioned, we have raised the stakes, so to speak, in order to make sure that new equipment is used, high definition broadcasting takes place, and, of course, create an environment where creation also can take place. On the news side, as I said, I'm a politician. I can only criticize. If I see something that I feel that is not like the way it is presented, I have the democratic right to say it. As I have been criticized for the choices of this government fiercely and sometimes without, you know, justification. But, I mean, this is my approach.
This is part of the dialogue. I mean, we will never say to anybody what to broadcast or not. The regulator is there, the constitution is there, and I would say also self-responsibility also should be there. The constitution is clear. Opinions should be presented in a balanced way, and I'm afraid this is not the case. Now, we had another question on the scarce resource. I mean, the spectrum is finite, it's not infinite, and it is a scarce resource because we have to give what is called the second dividend to the telecom industry, and we are left with a particular part of the spectrum that is being used from by the TV channels to broadcast their program. Again, I'm saying that this might not be a problem of the future. I am not in a position to predict how near this kind of future is going to be. Because, as I said before, new technologies can be a source of inequality. Imagine if we have areas of the country that do not have connectivity in super-fast broadband, high-speed. They will never be able to access and enjoy non-linear TV, on-demand television. And that is going to be unfair, undemocratic, and create new inequalities. But why this scarce resource of the nation is being used, it has to be used by the rules that our democracy decides. And the third, about state TV, to my knowledge, I mean, I left Great Britain, Scotland, Glasgow, not East End, in 2008. At that point, it was, I think, 10 quid per month.
Yes.
Yes. Well, in Greece, it's only 3 euros per month. It's 36 euros per year. It has been proved that this is something we must perceive. I'll give you an example. There are private TV stations that do not have correspondents in the basic cities of the country. So we have a phenomenon of terrible weather, for example. It is only the state television that can give a clear picture of all around the country what exactly is going on, having a correspondent there, having a camera, having somebody to present and report what exactly is happening. That is keeping the country together. It's not something that we can say, okay, we didn't fit in the business plan, so we can just leave it aside. No, it's not like that. If the state TV is not broadcasted, I visited 3 small islands like 4 or 5 months ago. Agathonisi, Arkous, and Lipsous. You know, these people there, they couldn't watch television. The signal never got there after 2013 because the digital transformation of terrestrial TV left them outside. Why? Because they did not fit in the business plan of the private company that developed the network. Excuse me, but I mean, this is not a luxury that our democracy has got. Forget about those citizens. And I'm talking about citizens that live in remote islands very close to our neighbors. Needless to say how crucial it is for the state to be there. So what did we do? We spent some money and gave those people satellite dishes so that they can watch free-to-air TV channels.
Okay. In England, we tend to watch the TV to find out about the weather as well, but the weather doesn't change. We still complain about the TV. Anyway,
it's not a program full of surprises.
Colleague here, please. Thank you.
Hello.
Yes, Yanni.
It's Yannis Apostolopoulos. Before I ask my question, you mentioned earlier on that journalists need to double-check their sources and what they're broadcasting. And I could only remember ERT, the national television, broadcasting news that there's a pack of robbers that were caught by the police before they were, because they were splitting the kitchen rolls into two and they were selling them as toilet papers. A news that was actually released by Kuluri, which is a funny fake news site. Just pointing this out. Now, my question. During your speech, you said that on the previous status quo, DGR pretty much could regulate how many companies could get into the news media world because, you know, they control that. That's fine and dandy. I agree with you. The more the options, the better. But on the same time, during your first version of the reform, you made adjustments for only four news companies to be able to get there. And I'm getting a bit confused. How on one side you can not agree with limiting the people that get into the news world, and on the other hand, have lesser companies than what it was during the existing
okay.
status.
Good, thanks. It was the question next to you.
Hi, Dr. Papas. My name is Yanis Grammatikos. I'm an engineer working in London. I enjoyed the example of anti-Syriza propaganda you just showed. I think it's spot on. I wanted to ask, are you equally sensitive when it comes to pro-Syriza propaganda?
What's he going to say? I love it?
I think it's a legitimate question.
It is purely legitimate, but I would like to listen to some examples.
Yeah. Could you just give some meaning to that?
You just need to buy the document on newspaper in Greece. There are like pro-government means to project news that are not entirely true, or not entirely substantiated, I would say. I have seen diagrams, not of this ridiculousness, but I have seen distortion of diagrams. I have a specific one in mind.
Okay.
It was a satirical show, but it is still a means to distribute news.
Okay. And the gentleman behind you there, please. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Hi. Is it?
Yes.
Okay. Isaac Aripidis, I'm a Greek correspondent as well. Probably the answer for fake news all around the world is the quality of journalism, which we don't have it, and we don't, especially we don't have it in Greece. We used to be here 10 years ago about 15 Greek correspondents. We are almost four. And some of us, they do also other jobs in order to survive. Or we work for many media in order to survive. So what does your government do in order to boost up the quality of journalism in Greece? Thank you.
Okay, and then I think there was some other questions in the centre. I've missed that. Okay. Yes, I thought so. Could we have the lady in the centre, please?
Okay, you specifically mentioned the regulator as an impersonal, you know, watchdog. How has your government secured that this regulator is actually an impartial instrument that will regulate equally public TV and private channels as well as the rest of the press?
Okay, thank you. And any last questions? And the gentleman is sat in front of me here.
Hi, thanks. Vasilis Panastagiotis from the LSE. Just following on that, it's quite interesting as an observation that you're referring to self-regulation by online media and to independent authorities of regulation. I think this is a model that came out mainly from this country, from a different kind of political persuasion. But can I ask you specifically on your story of continuity, that there was always kind of fake news, and this is different in terms of how it moves, but that it, otherwise it's kind of a continuum from the past. I think, yes, of course, we had propaganda and misinformation and partiality in the media and perhaps linked to government, to business interests and things. Isn't it problematic to then brand this, you know, to overemphasize this continuity, given the fact that what seems to be the problem with the fake news is the inability of the receiver to assess the information, to evaluate the information, and then that it is very decentralized. So the two characteristics, I think, which are important and different from the past is this decentralization, that you don't have you know, the bad media mongol that sort of, you know, decide what to publicize. But it's very decentralized. And then because of the complexity of information, it is very difficult to process it. You say journalists should double-check their sources. It's impossible. You know, when there's a news coming out every split second, it's impossible to check all sources. So maybe analytically, it makes sense to think of fake news as a different category, which is not something that comes from the past, but it's a new thing altogether.
Okay. And the last question over here, please.
My name is George Hatsiyoannou. I would like to ask you, Athens News Agency, which is under your jurisdiction, has signed agreements, cooperation agreements, with the Turkish News Agency, the Russian News Agency, RIA Novosti. It used to cooperate with TASS, ITAR TASS, but they switched to RIA Novosti, the Chinese News Agency. My question is, did they sign similar agreements with BBC or any other Western news agencies? Thank you.
Starting from the last, they have recently signed an agreement with their counterpart in the US. With Britain, I don't think they have it. Do they have an agreement? Yes, they are in discussion, but they have recently signed with their US counterpart. So, I mean, I think they follow a very balanced policy, and it helps the country, because exchanging content and making sure that the news about our country go to audiences that are of that magnitude is quite important, and we should.
But I guess his question is suggesting a bias that looking more east than west.
No, that's what I said. I said that they have already signed an agreement with the U.S. counterpart. And that was also in the framework, I would suggest, of the fact that the U.S. is the honored country in the Thessaloniki International Fair 2018. So... No, it's not a special case. It's something that is a strategic choice, and it's going to go on in the future, and I'm very optimistic that it's going to produce results as well. Now, yes, decentralization is the new thing, but I would keep arguing for a sense of continuity in terms of propaganda. And being on the optimistic side of things, I would say that decentralization can be a powerful tool in the hands of the consumer of content. That is our way to double check. Now, can the journalist double check because the news are spread very fast? Excuse me. I mean, everybody's talking about government reshuffle these hours in Greece. I have received around like 40 messages on my mobile.
Offering you jobs?
Huh?
Offering you jobs? No.
Tricky. No, what I'm saying is, as the news spread very fast, there are ways to double-check your sources very fast. I mean, it's only a few seconds away to double-check whether something that you have heard here is verified. And, of course, in my eyes, there is an obligation to mention what the other source has to say about the issue, which is not the case always. Now, how do we secure that the regulator will do its job? Democracy is the answer. The regulator is appointed by an enhanced majority from the College of Presidents of the Parliament. I cannot see any other form of building greater consensus about the people that will take places in there. It needs an 80% majority of the College of Presidents of the Parliament. And that's why sometimes it takes very long, like 15 years or 20 years, to appoint new people. You know, I mean, the regulator was degenerate before we started pressing for the new licensing procedure. I mean, people had resigned, it was only 2 out of 9 members. It was a situation that, it was a shame, it was a joke. Now, my friend mentioned something about the correspondence. You see, I mean, the channel that has got a license for a countrywide broadcasting, shouldn't they have correspondence in the major capitals of Europe and the US? Well, they don't now. Shouldn't be the case that they should be obliged to have that service? What kind of news do they present to the people? Is what they overheard through the wall, or just they go on the web and they report what other news agencies? They don't have people in the field, and that's fine. No, I don't think this should be the case. So like they should be obliged to have correspondence in major cities of the country, they should be obliged to have correspondence in major capitals. Again, there was somebody mentioned about satire. I think in satire there are no limits. And I mean, we, the people that are in politics, we have to be ready to listen to anything, even if what we hear about ourselves makes us sometimes angry. But that's the way it should be. Of course, I mean, we should not tolerate lies that have got to do with our integrity or anything like that. But I think it's part of the game and we have to accommodate with that. There was also a question on the number of licenses again. We should not confuse it. The number of licenses is not chosen in order to secure pluralism. Pluralism should be secured even if we had one or two channels, because each and every one of them has to secure pluralism. It's not like I have MSNBC and Fox News, so okay, we have a balance. Each and every TV station has to be in accordance to what our constitution suggests, and that is present different opinions in a balanced way.
I guess, but if I remember the question correctly, it was also that you were saying that technology suggests a number of licenses. First time round, you'd suggested four licenses. Mm-hmm. Now it's seven.
Now it's six.
Okay.
Now it's six. Why? I mean, the difference, one, is small, and second, it takes away, I mean, the developments have taken away the whole argument that has been there in the public domain that the license should be without any limit. This is not the case. We're talking about free-to-air channels. Never, nowhere in the world you have limitless channels. And at the point of discussion, we had pending negotiations with our neighbors in terms of the attribution and the allocation of frequencies. So this is now concluded, and we have a very clear idea of what the limits are. In any case, the difference is small, and we have accommodated with what the regulator has suggested, and it has been proved that less people than the available licenses showed up. So I think that the discussion about the number of licenses is successfully concluded, so to speak.
Okay, very good. I think we're successfully concluding tonight's event. I know the minister's time is very tight, and he's already said he's had about 40 messages. Allegedly, not one of them is offering him a cabinet post.
I'm not going to respond to any of them. That's a little secret, because okay, whatever you say in these cases might be used against you.
Very good. But before I ask the audience to join me in thanking you, can I give you something to remember the LSE occasion by? And this is something to put on your desk when you're back at the in Athens. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Often we give a baseball cap, but I thought for Nikos this is too cheap.
Yeah, but I mean, you're not getting away without a baseball cap as a gift. Oh, okay, so, thank you so much.
Okay.
But you have also promised the letter.
I will.
You had sent me 10 years ago saying that you're offering a 6-month contract in LSE.
Very good. Very good. Remember, I'm from Yorkshire. We don't do generosity. Can you please join me in thanking our speaker tonight?